You know what I want? I want a coffee drink.
Hello and welcome to the Raptors Weekly Podcast. I'm your Samson Folk. After a long hiatus, was kind of giving myself a break before we jump back into things. But the draft is coming fast and furious. We're 10 days, 9 days away from it right now. So I thought, who better to talk to than a draft expert about the Raptors prospects, who they're looking at, who's worth trading up towards, and a guy who knows a lot about the game, PD. You can find him on Twitter at AboveTheBreak3. He has one of the best bang for your buck patrons out there because a lot of the stuff on there is free, actually, and you can go read very detailed reports on a number of things, whether it be guys who are in the league or prospects coming into it. He has a great handle on what makes players go, the development to get there. PD, how you doing, man? How you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. I'm excited to talk about the Raptors. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Okay, so first thing, let's get right into it then. We're talking about guys who might fall in this draft, and it's been referred to as a flat draft, where it's the guys at the very top, maybe subtract the, well, I guess the conventional wisdom has been there's a top three if you listen to the mainstream guys. Maybe if you go into the more granular things, it gets a little bit more flat. Maybe it gets a bit more top heavy, depending on who you're reading. But there is the aspect of the Raptors looking at guys who might want to trade up to get them. We've heard about Masai going after Shai Gilgeous-Alexander at times. And he also went after Giannis Antetokounmpo. Those attempts to get higher up in the draft to grab those guys. Or in Giannis's case, just get into the draft. Who are those guys for the Raptors that you're seeing would be worth it to trade up for?
So I think the first name that jumps out is Killian Hayes, who's somebody that, depending on draft order and depending on draft fit, I would be comfortable taking in the top three. The Warriors don't necessarily have a need for it. But Killian's skill set is one that would really help a team that needs a secondary creator. We're talking about a 6'6", hyper creative, left-handed, like guard wing, who provides three-level ability in terms of creativity, can create out of pick and rolls, can basically be an adult on offense, somebody who, you know, is capable of running a scheme and being the focus point, depending on what you have, which is great for this Raptors team, who kind of can use more juice, but also has times where, you know, Kyle and Siakam need their minutes. So it's the idea of a scalable guard who fits the timeline, sort of. And if he develops as Kyle gets older, then you have a star in your hands that could really help this team become a dynasty in terms of contending in the East, or it could just help right now. I think that's the greatest disparity between people on Twitter.com and to what we consider mainstream sites is the adoration of Killian Hayes. The draft people on Twitter really, really enjoy him. The NBA people, including the ones that I've talked to, worry about the standard stuff of like how athletic is he, how, you know, left hand dominant is he, and I think that those are things I'm not really worried about because he's a really good passer, even though he is left hand dominant. Usually, when you have guys who are super left hand dominant, you worry about them being mediocre. But Killian was legitimately excellent in a pretty good league, and his creativity allows him to create angles so that even if that right hand gets mediocre, you're now looking at a fully ambidextrous creative player.
Yeah, when I watch Killian, I mean, it's easy to think of D'Lo, and especially since D'Lo was such a gifted passer at Ohio State as well, and a guy who not only sees angles, but is willing enough to go after them. Like, he's not exactly a risk-averse passer, if we're talking about D'Lo, but with Killian, Is it just the, I guess, the middling numbers as far as three-point shooting that, I guess, draft people on Twitter, myself as well, think will probably bump up? We like that. I guess I like his mechanics a lot more than some other shooters in the draft or guys who are sitting a little bit lower. I know we're going to talk about Tyrese Maxey at some point, another guy who probably people are expecting, if they're high on him, to kind of ameliorate with his shooting percentages. But Killian is a shooter. And so when you're looking at how he might get into the Raptors roster. Is this a guy that we could see fall out of the top 10? Is he, could he go as low as like a 15? What is his range, do you think?
His range, depending on who you talk to, is probably from 4 to 16. Like there are people who will say that he's like a late teens pick, which to me is madness. I think the shooting comes down to how comfortable a player development staff is teaching rhythm. Killian is a much, much, much better shooter off the dribble than he is catch and shoot, because he doesn't standardize the rhythm of his shot. So a lot of times you'll see him, you know, it's left foot, right foot, then there's a beat, then he shoots. Other times it's, you know, off the hop and it's one fluid motion. So standardizing his jumper is going to be the difference from his catch and shoot numbers. Having the Raptors player development staff and player development track record has sort of been the metric that I use to create how much teams should be afraid of drafting projects, saying repeatedly, you don't have the Raptors development staff. The Raptors do have the Raptors development staff. So if anyone should be confident in taking swings on guys who may be a little bit more difficult of development, or, you know, things that other people might still see on the mystical side rather than the what can be improved side, this is a marriage made in heaven.
Yeah, I would be really excited. He's, to me, I'm not sure about LaMelo Ball. I'm not a draft guy. I've picked up on 6 or 7 guys. I've read some of your stuff. I read Robel and I read like a lot of the mainstream stuff as well. So my opinions are an amalgamation of all that kind of stuff. But Killian, I think, is my favorite prospect in the draft. So I'd be ecstatic to see him go to the Raptors and see how he could work in their system. And so let's talk about a guy who is perceived to be a home run or a bust in waiting. That's Poku. What do you think about him? And if we're talking about the Raptors developing a guy, is he maybe the biggest example of that?
Yeah. So Alexei Pokuševski is the most interesting player in this class, hands down. He is like a 7-foot like combo guard. He played in the Greek B division by methods of not his own choosing. He clearly didn't want to be there. And in Europe, there's not as much of, there is no incentive to play players who are going to go to the NBA. So he got, you know, 20 minutes a game in the Greek second division. There's going to be comparisons to guys like Kristaps Porzingis and Dragan Bender, because Alexei is like white and European. He makes both of them look like the shyest people on earth. He's essentially 7-foot J.R. Smith in terms of his decision making. He will attempt to throw passes that I've never seen another person throw, whether it's like fake behind the back pass, underhand lobs to like 5'11 point guards. And it's like, I understand what you're thinking. The audacity is the strongest thing. Like, his strongest skill is that he will try things. And oftentimes they're like of the LaMelo Ball stripe, where it's like, no, this is a legitimately creative guy who sees himself as a problem solver for a defense. He is really skinny. He's built pretty strangely. Long neck, big head, somewhat wide shoulders. It's not super concerning, but like, instead of thinking of him as like, oh, he's a 7'1" guy, he's probably more like small forward size, but with, you know, some different body sizes. On defense, he is a fantastic rotation player. He is capable of understanding angles at a pretty crazy rate, considering his weird development background. When you watch skinny guys, you always want to wonder, like, if they have a lot of fight in them. And Poku thinks he can stand up to, you know, the monsters of the world. If there's a 7-footer trying to dunk, he's going to go up and try to get it, because in his mind, like, that's the ball that he should have. Same with steals. So you get a player who can shoot. He takes a lot of step backs, a lot of double step backs off the dribble. It damages his percentages. I think the shot is better than the numbers. He's 40-32-78 across three areas. But again, the shot selection is, you know, a bored teenager who's under challenged by his variety. Half his shots were threes, but only 20% of his shots were free throws. And not ideal. But when you have the Raptors development system, what you can do is take a guy with super high feel who's on the very skinny side and needs reps. You can send him between 905 and the Raptors. You can give him minutes when it's needed. You can have him practice with the team and challenge him, and then send him down to 905 and say, okay, take 9 threes in this half. See what happens. This is the development model that you would want for, you know, high feel players who need reps to sort what they are as players. And having a team where your best post defender is your Philadelphia point guard, you know, your best wing defender is like just a jumbo wing. Your best ball handler is covered in butter, Pascal Siakam. Like, this is a team that sort of is built on accentuating some unique characteristics. And if you were to say, I'm a successful team with a successful player development program who can afford a big swing, this is the player who's most unique in this class by a huge amount, and one that also makes a lot of sense with what the Raptors may need in the future.
As far as his shooting, are we looking at what's the disparity between pull up and catch and shoot for Poku?
I can pull that up on. Oh no, I don't have the synergy handy. If you give me one moment, I can pull that up.
While you're doing that, as far as like the mechanics, where you're referring to rhythm with Killian, do you have any insights as far as Poku is concerned?
Yeah, it's his lower body that seems to be like his rhythm is pretty good. He has some hand placement issues, and he has, again, being a skinny guy, you're going to have some lower leg issues, which is to be expected. I think that on the upper body, the biggest concern is that he shoots out instead of up, leading to some flat and strange angled, like hard shots that just clang off the rim. And then his gather point is a little bit funny. I think that he has a diagonal shooting bed, so like his fingers don't make an L. It's sort of if you hold your hand like a karate chop and then try to, you know, push your finger forward or push your index finger forward, it's not going to work. You're going to want to shoot with your ring finger or your middle finger. And so he'll miss in a number of different directions, especially off the dribble. So the mechanics are fine. But the consistency of those mechanics are a little more of a problem. And
okay.
I think that if you're looking for a guy who played in a, you know, a lower level of Greece, and I know the joke that it looks like the YMCA, but like these are dudes who are stronger than him. So he had to deal with actual problems of being like, it's Europe, so fouls don't exist. And like they, when he was handling, people would get into his handle and just, you know, make sure that he was facing similar problems to what he'll face in the NBA. This wasn't a case of like, you know, a true center playing against 5'7" dudes where he could just dunk over them. It's much closer to like what Denny faced in Israel, where like there's a similar problem. It's on the opposite side in terms of competition level. But there is a similarity with the problems that he faced at his overseas level and what he will face in the NBA.
Just as something I'm interested in, since you know so much about the development of the game and how shooters develop, and maybe you haven't written a book like Nick Nurse or anything like that, but you seem to have a good grasp on it. As far as guys who achieve really high numbers in as far as plurality or like their, what would the term be? The just how many they're launching, like guys like Marcus Smart or guys like Luka. I know they're obviously not one-to-one comparisons, those two, but guys who there's a lot of catch and shoot in their game. In Marcus Smart's case, a guy who shoots significantly better as far as, or not catch and shoot, sorry, pull up, a guy who shoots significantly better when pulling up, and Luka, a guy who pulls up all the time but has a middling percentage. It's even, you know, it's like what, around 32%. What do you think about the disparity between pull up and catch and shoot, and which do you find is a better indicator of where a guy is going to go and how he's able to manipulate a defense or create spacing with his shot?
So as a creator, you need to be able to shoot off the dribble. And the effectiveness of off the dribble shooting is going to directly correspond to how likely that a, you know, wing to small size player is going to be useful. If you don't have any creation equity, you need to be able to catch and shoot. There's a There's a guy named Christian Doolittle in this draft who like doesn't take catch and shoots. He only shoots off the dribble, and he's a good shooter off the dribble, but just never takes catch and shoots because he's bad at them. And he's, you know, a very deep sleeper, because like, what are you supposed to do with that? Like, if you can't spot him up, you sort of have to like have him catch it at like 3 steps beyond the 3-point line, have him dribble up and shoot. Like, this gets into like deep Reddit thought territory, where people are doing experiments on the future of the game. I think that with everyone's mechanics, there are holes in them. Guys who have like really like wide gather positions struggle to shoot on catch and shoots because they're used to shooting, you know, way off their hips. And, you know, there's an evolutionary development from their usage in high school youth to college pros as it goes forward. Like, we'll talk about this with Maxi some. Is that like you have to retrain people, and it can be difficult to adjust to roles because everyone has an internal usage for how they believe the game should be played. Like, this was Lonzo's struggle, was that like you could goad him into not shooting because in his brain, if he shot 3 shots in a row, he would not shoot the 4th time because he had this internal logic of how the game should be played, and it wasn't him shooting 4 times in a row. And so if you shot twice, you could sell it on that next pass because he was not going to do it. I think with Poku, he wants to shoot a lot more off the dribble than I think I would be comfortable with, especially initially as you solve the shooting inconsistencies. For guys with great touch, there's obviously hope that they're going to shoot. Like, that's always the bet with Aiden and the wonderful mid-range guys. So to answer your question in a long way, it depends on how you want them to be used. But the most important thing is finding where the holes in their mechanics are and trying to minimize the exposure to their difficulties, and figuring out the best way possible to create a safe environment for their misses. Like, Marcus Smart was allowed to take a whole bunch of wide open threes for a long time because eventually it was going to be needed for him to shoot them. And you know, he's turned the corner on that. But creating an environment where it's like, look, if you're open, you gotta shoot. It doesn't matter how many you miss. Like, you can be the worst shooter in the NBA, and I think for a period of time he was on a certain volume. But the math was eventually going to shake out because he had good touch and had a history of scoring. And to look at Poku's numbers, like, you see another guy. You see a guy who has incredible touch and has some very interesting indicators. And at a certain point, if you're a good team, like, why not?
Before we get on to Maxi, because I'm assuming most of these guys, I guess for the, you can interrupt me if I'm incorrect, but we'll say they'll command roughly the same package if it's, because it doesn't matter which guy is falling. I mean, maybe it does in the conversations and how many, mm-hmm. you know, I guess teams are trying to get up in the draft, but because we don't know what they're thinking, let's assume it's static. Is this like a Norman Powell plus X and O? Is this X and O plus Malcolm Miller? Like, what do you think it takes to get into the middle of the draft for the Raptors from 29? Let's assume that 29 is packaged in.
Yeah. I would say Norman Powell 29, and then like probably taking on a little bit worse of a contract. Like, that makes sense to me. I think that this draft has a lot of interesting players in this second plateau. So like, you sort of have this first like 8 or whatever that depend on team fit, and then like 8 to 20 are guys that like, for the right developmental situation and team framework, are either incredibly useful or just like teams can do nothing with them. So I think there's going to be a lot of teams who have like, you know, 12 or 16 trying to move back and trying to solidify themselves into a playoff team. And I think we're going to see a lot of good teams try to move up to find guys that they like teams that need lane sprinters who could shoot. So like the traditional Oklahoma City guy are going to love RJ Hampton. They're going to be like, he's the fastest guy in this draft. He has a 37-inch vertical, and he's a developing shooter. That's extremely valuable to a team that needs lane runners. But most bad teams, like, that's not a checklist item for them. That's not a foundational item. So I think that there's going to be a lot of sellers in that range. And guys like Maxi are extraordinarily valuable if you have a jumbo initiator.
So we're saying a guy like, for example, next to a jumbo initiator as far as like heliocentric, or a big guy like a Jokic,
Jumbo to me is anybody who it requires a defense to stop from getting to the rim. Like, it does. Pascal fits in that. Like, you can't just take one guy with Pascal, because if you leave Pascal one-on-one, like, you need to send help over top. So a defense is already tilted just by the presence of a jumbo initiator being on the floor. It takes four guys to guard LeBron. So I think that if you want to like really ratchet this up and think of it as heliocentric, but I think that at a lower level, it's just guys that are automatically like a defense is in rotation because they have the ball in their hands. So like if Pascal catches it at 21 and is dribbling hard to his right, a defense has to be at that midline and they have to be sending help. And should he pass out to, say, a Tyrese Maxey, a guy whose struggle in college was that he couldn't beat a defense straight up. He couldn't be the guy who made the defense rotate, but as a legendary finisher, as a guy who makes good reads when a defense is tilted, that's suddenly an extraordinarily valuable player archetype. Now, if I'm, you know, a team that needs a primary, Maxey probably isn't going to be that useful to me unless I believe that he's the finishing, or that the high school / UIBL shooting numbers were real, and the Kentucky shooting numbers or whatever. Which is a thing that I personally believe. But if you're just looking at this as a team who has the guy who can make the first rotation, suddenly Maxey is 10 times more valuable to me than it would be to, like, I don't know, Detroit, who just like can't do anything with him.
Mm. So like the fit would be similar to Eric Gordon on Houston, like a guy who can really punch a gap and punish like the weak side of a defense, a rotating defense, and a guy who will just pay. Just operating that tertiary role.
Yeah. It very similar to that. And like, you know, just like, you know how Milwaukee has like seven dudes where you're like, they had this guy, he can shoot and he's strong. It's just this morass of skills that are, you know, attacking gaps, finishing at the rim, making free throws, the ability to shoot down the line, and all of his individual flaws, be they like the ability to read, you know, two defenders at once, or, you know, maybe lacking the straight point guard defense. Like he can guard up, but he can't necessarily guard, you know, point of attack ones. That doesn't really matter when you have Kyle Lowry. Like there are the type of players that good teams have make Maxey extremely valuable. The type of players that bad teams have make Maxey look bad.
Okay. So, of the three guys, you said that the perfect marriage is Killian Hayes plus Raptors. Poku sounds like another guy who's ideal for them with their ability to go, as you said, to kind of oscillate between 905 and Raptors and to just go between those two. And Maxey, obviously a guy, if the Raptors keep Fred VanVleet, the Terrence Davis stuff regarding his alleged, well, there's charges laid against him for quite a few things that involve hitting his girlfriend, among other things. And their guard positions are kind of in flux right now. It seems like Maxey and Killian Hayes slide in there right away. What position does Poku kind of slide into? Just to go back to that quick, what position does Poku slide into on that roster?
I think that he slides into the idea of, like, if you wanted to play OG down, if you wanted to get as many, like, if you wanted to space for shooting, and you wanted to go with like a blitz lineup where you're just putting as many speedy people on the floor. Maybe it's a Fred Kyle lineup. Maybe it's, you know, maybe it's three guards, Poku and OG at the five. Like, you can use this as a way of getting to individual lineups. It also maybe lineups where you go super big and Poku's the ball handler with an extra shooter in the corner. I think that with Poku, the idea probably is that like he'll contribute like 10 minute spurts his rookie year, where he's, you know, shot blocking and, you know, trying weird stuff on offense, but that it's an idea towards like the team that OG might be the second best player on or the first best player on. Like it's a play for small minutes now and large minutes later.
He would kind of fit, he wouldn't be Chris Boucher, but he'd emulate some of the things that we saw Chris Boucher kind of bring off the bench a little bit this past year, if I'm reading you correctly.
Yeah, he'd be like hyper offensive Chris Boucher. Mm. It would most likely be a punt on the first 2 years just because of the strength level. Like, I think that Poku's floor is much higher than people think, just because like guys who are really good at rotational defense with good timing don't really fail that often. That's just not like a skill that flops if the, you know, his body breaks down. But again, like, the list of guys who are absolutely unplayable because they were too skinny is not that long. So I think that this would be more of a move if, Van Fleet were to leave and there wasn't a replacement for him, and suddenly the timeline shifts a little bit because this team may not be the title team next year. It may take 2 years to gear back up. I think that Poku makes sense on that timeline. But again, when you're facing a draft like this, you can figure out what you want each team in the future to look like. Because there's so many different pathways to value as a good team.
So we're talking about the hellish blitzing defense of the Raptors, and that kind of makes me want to go to Zeke Nnaji. He had an incredible shuttle drill time. And before we start talking about him and how he might fit into the Raptors defense, and we start talking about guys at the Raptors, I suppose, regular spot 29 of Maxey, Hayes, Poku, who do you like the best? Who's your favorite prospect of those guys? And with that, who would you think is the most realistic for the Raptors to go and get?
I would say Killian's the most realistic to go and get. Because I feel like Masai continually bets on high feel guards. Like, that's a thing that seems to be one of his personal favorite things, is he gets linked to these guys who can read the floor pretty well. And that would be what Killian can do. And if you're expecting a port into a playoff team, you would want a young guy who can read the floor well. Also, you know, the difference in size between Hayes and Maxey is pretty dramatic. And if you're worried about, you know, Maxey maybe being a touch too small for playoff basketball, Hayes would offer that.
Okay. Okay. As far as, I guess let's start Zeke Nnaji then. Big year, freshman of the year. He had a great season as far as college. He had that incredible shuttle speed. And I'm wondering, as far as what you've seen from him, is that speed being applied in a beneficial way defensively? And does he have like the reads that you're saying, like Poku makes these great reads and help side, and like he's a great rotational defender? Guys who make great reads can stick in the league usually.
So
go ahead.
My apologies. I think that Nnaji can get two spots. Like he's very good at hedging. He could be a like guy who switches, you know, 3, 4, 5 at some point. I think that switch defender is one of those terms that exists in theory a lot more than it exists in practice. Just because, like, the idea of a guy who can switch 1 through 5, you know, covering Joel Embiid and De'Aaron Fox, is just, it's a dude that doesn't exist other than LeBron James. And even he might be past that point. I think that with Nnaji, you'd really have to, like, you need to put him next to a great communicator. While he's fantastic at getting out to spots on hard edges or soft edges, he struggles with his return paths. So he will get out to a spot, stop the ball handler, and then when he's to plug back into the defense, there is an issue with that. It's sort of like the inverse of Marc Gasol, who like barely would get to places and then he'd plug back in perfectly. And you're like, how did you recover that well? Like, you slow old man. So that to me strikes me as a young person thing, but it will get absolutely eaten alive in playoff basketball. Because you could just hit that with like Spain or really drag out the pick and roll and make those help rotations you know, longer and longer when he has to recover after the hedge. The shooting is real. Listed, you know, 29% on small volume, but Arizona is not a place that allows anyone really space, especially their bigs. He was known as a shooter in high school in AAU. Small block rate, but again, Arizona's been known to depress that a little bit. I think that he's an interesting pick at 29. I wouldn't necessarily think of him as the most imaginative pick, especially considering the breadth of the player development program. He's a guy who like will be a solid guy almost assuredly, but I don't think that he would be the best allocation of resources because that threshold is so easy to get, especially in this draft.
Yeah, his shooting, it looks like a really solid base. Like, it's a very fundamental straight up and down jumper, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, I mean, he has like the jumper of the guy you would show in like shooting videos. Like for a guy who's that big, like when the camera pans out, you're like, wow, it's straight up and down. You know, it's a little robotic looking, but that doesn't really bother me as long as the numbers shake out. But like, you forget that he's, you know, an almost 7 foot tall person because you watch him shoot. You're like, that's a good stroke. Oh, he's a center. That's a really nice stroke. It's a good, it's an especially good jumper for pick and pops, just because of how consistent the timing is. I don't expect versatility from him. Like, you aren't going to run him off pin downs or anything like that. Just based on what I've seen previously, but like that doesn't seem impossible down the line. You know, second contract Zeke Najee is probably shooting, you know, off some pin downs or some big to big actions. But again, this goes to a timeline question of with this 29th pick, do you want people who contribute now? Do you want people who contribute now with a bet on upside later? Or do you want people who are all upside later?
What do you like for the Raptors as far as like if you're idealizing your version of their team that has the most success and has the biggest payoff from this pick at 29, who's your guy?
I mean, if I can get Grant Riller, I would love that.
Yeah, he's great. He's like a legendary finisher at the rim. He's immaculate.
Yeah, he finishes better than quite a few like college centers. It's nuts. There's the, you know, standard caveat about he didn't necessarily play the greatest competition in the CAA, but watching him finish, there's nothing about it that you think. I mean, he did play games, you know, against higher ranked KenPom teams, but when you watch the finishes, there's nothing about it that says like this is a fluke or he wouldn't do that versus, you know, an NBA sized guy. There's just incredible contortion, the ability to find angles, the ability to create space, like everything you could want from an older guard. Playing at a lower level, Grant really does it.
So when we're talking about Grant, when we're looking at his fit on the Raptors, let's say it's time for him to get to his second contract. We're looking at an extension. What would you expect his role to be within the team?
I think that he would just take all of the possessions that Fred VanVleet has now. Like, that's the role that you would want him in. He's not the guy who's going to carry an offense. At an NBA level, you have to expect some translation knockdown from the, you know, 22-5 he averaged it in college. But the idea of a secondary guy who can create portable offense from a variety of different mechanisms, who's, you know, capable as a distributor and as a shooter, as well as just getting their own bucket, especially against, you know, second lines in the NBA, in a world where Pascal or OG has continued their ability to create. You have Riller just to fill in the gaps in that in a multitude of different ways.
What's his defense like? I haven't seen really anything as far as his defense goes.
He has college superstar defense. So he's pretty much just out there saving energy. He's a strong dude. So I think that like, he's going to be like passable bad probably in the league. I mean, it's difficult when you're the team's entire offense and you're getting doubled every single possession, basically, or getting five sets of eyes on you every single possession. It's hard to also like really turn out major effort on defense, but it's a concern. It's a major concern.
Okay. As far as, okay, let's move to another guy then that you wrote about extensively, a guy that Raptors Twitter actually likes quite a bit, and a guy who also played in France, similar to Killian, Theo Maledon. I have a little snippet written about him. I'll read it off. So somebody who Masai has been, I guess, linked to back in January, there's comparisons a little bit to SGA, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. I see that a little bit just with how he finishes those long loping steps and these kind of extended finishes at the rim. Some of them underhand. I like a lot. He's talented. But as you laid out in your writing, quote, my biggest worry is that he may be the true neutral guard on an NBA floor. So capable to be league average and so risk averse to be unwilling to be more. So talented manipulators get lost in the shuffle all the time. DeLon Wright, I think, is a good example of that. Is Nick Nurse's flowing read and react system a fit for Maledon? Would you be excited to see him drafted to Toronto?
I think that it would be a good fit, but I think that excited might be a little far because Théo seems to fit the whatever container he's in. Like if you give him a larger role, he'll take it, but he doesn't go beyond that. So when there's two-on-ones, he'll throw the safe pass almost every single time. He waits until there's like a really low percentage chance of a turnover before he does anything. Like if you watch Poku and then watch Théo back to back, you get whiplash because one dude is throwing into windows that don't exist yet or like don't exist on this plane of reality. And then Théo is like waiting until there's a 0% chance of a turnover before throwing it. It's difficult to get a guy to break away from that. And it extends beyond his passing. His passing is the most obvious one where you're like, okay, you could just throw a no look and it'd be a dunk. And instead he takes an extra dribble and passes down. But it presents in his finishing. It presents in his game management. It presents in his shot selection. He's not an unwilling shooter, but he doesn't take shots that the team couldn't get a better one later in that possession.
So as far as like the shots he's creating, he's not willing to be adventurous enough to get the really easy buckets. Like, for example, Kyle Lowry, who I know is a very tough guy to be compared to, but Lowry is constantly presenting. Like, he's good at the little pocket pass to Serge on the short roll or on the pick and pop. Like, he has those in his bag, but there's a variance to his passing that always keeps the defense on its toes, and Maledon is more so formulaic in what he's creating.
Yeah, I mean, it feels very like, you know, the criticism of the Rockets where you feel like you're watching the same thing over and over again. That's what Maledon's decision making feels like to me, where it's like you can sort of just judging by what the defense gives you, you can bet pretty consistently on what he's going to do. I think that the shooting is going to work out. He's a guy who shoots, you know, across his three levels is 42, 33, 77. There's some, you know, some small tweaks that need to be made, but that's not the thing that really concerns me. I think that with Théo, like, I don't see how he becomes a star, which like for the Raptors is probably not necessary, but like there are routes for guys late in this draft. If I can go on a small, sure, thing here, like the last decade has, or, you know, from basically 2005 till 2015, we see like the intersection of like advanced stats and X's and O's. People kind of figure out how to play basketball after hand checking goes away. So Mike D'Antoni runs wild. Then we get a counter movement. Then we get people who say, oh, well, what if we paired extremely high pace with some old school ideas? You know, we, instead of having guys come off 15 foot pin downs, what if they come down double staggers for threes? And then the decade following that is the intersection of big data and player development. More than almost ever, we see guys who get drafted later in drafts, you know, late lottery, late first round, second round, become stars because they all have these interesting data profiles. And the NBA has figured out how player development works for specific things. So every team sort of has the answer for what they believe can be fixed in a player and what they believe can't be fixed in a player. And so we see guys like Nikola Jokic, who, you know, watching his Mega Baymax tape was like, there's the least athletic dude you could imagine. But he threw passes that Sabonis, you know, just, it would make Sabonis cry. And you think, okay, well, can I make the athleticism either better or not matter? And Denver's answer was, yeah, but we think we can figure that out. You know, with Kawhi, he's, you know, an awful true shooter. When you look at his college numbers, he's a guy who lived off like just really tough shots to get there. But he was capable of defending four positions in college, and people looked at his shooting form and said, yeah, I think we can fix that. With Théo, I don't necessarily see what he's good at right now, or what he's bad at right now, and turning that into a star is something that in player development I don't believe is really possible. A guy who operates with like a supreme sense of competence, but not necessarily one of risk taking, not one of like living with advantage creation and just like, you know, letting it go. Like Luka Doncic's whole thing was like, I'm going to create advantage no matter what, and I'm going to live with what happens afterwards. And Teo sort of seems to me to be the opposite. I'm going to live with competence just because I, you know, this is sort of the downside of playing the right way, is that like you can live with playing the right way because you know it's the right decision. But when you watch him play, that's not necessarily a pathway for his stardom. It's a way for his teams to be solid.
So a guy who the back end, the help side sinks, he's going to spray to the corner. They space out. He's going to hit the roll man. But when the pass is at its most wide open, not when it's at its most advantageous. And I guess if you want to create the best looks, you have to make it happen when it's at its most advantageous, not its safest. As far as, so Grant Riller is the guy you talked about being like, that's the guy the Raptors need to draft. Is there a guy in the front court that you really like? Because you said Zeke was not super exciting for you. He's gonna provide certain things that you say you can find, I guess, pretty easily. So who's the front court guy who excites you the most that might be available to the Raptors at 29?
Killian Tilly. Probably one of the most dominant college players of the last 4 years. Every time he was on the court, it's a ridiculous offensive mismatch. He's forward out of Gonzaga, a legendary shooter, hyper skilled. He has chronic issues with his feet. If he was not hurt, he would probably be like a top 15 draft pick. A guy who has the skills of a player who could turn an NBA playoff series. And if you're picking late in the draft, to me, the only thing that really matters is, you know, those last 16 wins. And finding a guy who can even give you one or two of those 16 wins is more valuable than, you know, a cheap contract or, you know, a guy who ends up to be okay value. It's like the actual value when you're a playoff team is, you know, getting to the next round. And while that seems pretty productive, when watching Killian Tilly, even just like taking a glance at his stats, it seems hard to envision getting a guy at 30 who can do the things he does. Again, I believe he has multiple years above 40% from three. All of his advanced numbers are absolutely nuts. In 24 games at Gonzaga this year, he had a 130 offensive rating against a 92 defensive rating, which is just, it's just ludicrous stuff. BPM of 12. There's so much to like here if he has the green light from a medical staff. This is not a matter of, you know, what is his skills, what does this translate? It's, can you get somebody to vouch for the ankles and the feet and the knee? Because every time he was on a court in college, it was unfair.
I typically really love the Gonzaga guys. Fun fact, I played not for Gonzaga, but I went to two summers in a row. I went to tournaments there. And got to hang out with, like, I know, and David Stockton and like the Kelly Olynyks and like Kevin Pangoses of the world were kind of hanging around showing us kind of what to do and reads to make and all that kind of stuff. Fun fact, David Stockton, I'm a left-handed shooter and he kept calling me goofy, and he beat me in a three-point competition shooting left-handed even though he's right-handed, and it was like the worst thing ever. But Killian Tilly, he's super fun, and it would be, why not aim for the ceiling play, right? Because the Raptors seem to be able to find floor players a lot, or at least kind of craft them out of players who are hanging around in the 905. Why not go for the guy who provides this incredible ceiling and amount of value where you're picking at? So Killian Tilly, how do you think he applies to the Raptors? Like, he's so dominant in college. It's that incredible shooting. But on the Raptors, how do you see the fit, provided that he's healthy?
Again, you can probably get away with playing him at the five if Pascal and OG are on the floor, and he spaces. Earlier, I misspoke and said he had two seasons over 40%. He's 44% for his career, and every season is above 40%. His lowest season is actually 40%. So I would apologize for slandering Killian Tilly by saying he was only sometimes a 40% three-point shooter. I mean, the combination of dribble, pass, shoot centers, even if he's only like 6'10", his offensive versatility is going to just, you're going to run five out. You're going to have space for basically any action you want. You can, you know, run high DHO with him, and defenses have to respect it. Forcing centers to close out hard and knowing that he can make a dribble and a good decision, knowing that he can get to the rim, you know, if a team closes out super hard, and knowing that he's, again, a legendary shooter. To me, this seems like, I don't want to say Marc Gasol replacement because he's nowhere near the defender, but in terms of a guy who will play spot minutes and be a court warper and a way for Nurse to draw up really interesting sets to get OG and Pascal in spots, where like Pascal works out of sort of these like half spaces in the NBA. And you have to get to lineups that make his life easier. Well, he is a great finisher around the rim. When bad lineups or bad actions or when defenses have the right personnel to gum up a little bit of the more normal stuff, it'd be nice to have a lineup where you say, okay, those half spaces are now full spaces. Like, now if we run, you know, Lowry, Tilly, pick and roll, like, you now have two excellent shooters and you better bring a third guy over to beat that rotation. And now if the ball goes to Pascal, there's a defense in rotation and he's able to get easier looks, which seemed to be the problem at the end of last year.
Yeah, agreed. He's a super exciting player. What, before we move on from him, what do you think the likelihood is that he hangs around to 29?
This one is pretty difficult because I think that a lot of teams value him above the first pick, above the, value him around that like late lotto, early 20s spot, but it's a matter of what a medical staff will sign off on. And so in that element, like if you told me that Killian Tilly went 15th, I'd be like, that makes a lot of sense. If you told me Killian Tilly went 45th because of the injury concerns and no medical staff signing off on him, you know, which has happened with like, you know, EK and Abogu or, you know, other guys who were first round talents in their draft, but didn't necessarily get the green light from medical staffs. Both of those circumstances make sense. How much faith do you currently have in the Raptors medical staff?
Quite a bit. I think they've shown quite a bit. Like, I think they deserve a good faith reading on most of the things they do, if I had to guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's my outside read. Granted, it's from quite a bit farther than you. So I'm sure there's, you know, ankle tweaks and, you know, finger jams that every fan base has their time that they think the medical staff played it wrong or whatever. But I mean, after the Kawhi thing alone, you know, there's the expectation that like the Raptors have as good of a medical staff as anybody else around, and are willing to take, have modern solutions to modern problems.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Is there anybody else you want to talk about that you'd like the Raptors to target? Some guys that you find interesting at the back end, and I can just kind of walk through it with you and learn some things.
Yeah, so I mean, I think Trey Jones is interesting. He's a jack of all trades, master of none guard. But he's also like a guy who, if you blended his two seasons together, would be like far more fascinating. I think he's also the guard most damaged by context in this draft. He returned to Duke into a situation that was set up for him to fail. They played just some awful lineups where a guy whose challenge was shooting was forced to shoot. And there were serious improvements made. But it wasn't a circumstance for him to ever really look good. You know, ACC player of the year, fantastic defender, took a little bit of a step back in his sophomore year. But a guy who I think is going to fall based on the difference between his freshman and sophomore year at Duke. I think he's probably a third guard, but he's a guy who, you know, he's more of a scorer than his brother. And I think that he was always considered to be the better Jones, even coming up through the high school ranks. He's wired a little bit more aggressively, and it's a guy who I keep coming back to him and be like, I think we're overthinking this. I think that there's so much good tape, and like, I generally think that shooting is super fixable, especially when it's like his issue seems to be his balance. Like, he just needs to like do more squats and just add a little more of the posterior chain. And bodies generally get fixed in the NBA. Like, everyone is really good at you know, sorting out balance issues for the most part. So that's a guy who, he's not going to be the most exciting pick, but I think that, to me, he has even more of a, like, he's seen as less of a star bet than Maledon, but I think that he might actually have a little more star equity just based on his ability to make things happen that Maledon can't.
Event creation is the term, right? Like, he can kind of shake it up. Yeah. Okay. That seems like a good list of guys for the listeners to chew on. So I want to appeal to how you look at the game. So there's a lot of minute details, that you refer to both on this podcast, in the own podcast that you have, and your writing, which, listeners, you can find on Patreon for free, or you can, you know, throw some money his way to help him keep doing the excellent coverage that he does. But there's a lot of the minute details that you talk about, a lot of attention to these, you know, same foot, same hand finishes, the type of English you're seeing on the ball when they're at the rim, the fundamentals of the jump shot, like the types of reads they're making as far as like in the pick and roll, how they're reading the back end of the defense, not just their primary defender. A lot of stuff that doesn't get attention, I think, in most popular, I guess, sports writing. There's not a lot of cliche in it. There's not a ton of player comparison. It's just these hard reads of what a player is doing. What made you look at the game this way? And what are the things that initially pop to you when you're watching a player for the first time? What do you look for?
Wow. Thank you for that extremely flattering description. I mean, basketball is my day job. So for me, this is always the way that I've kind of viewed it. The reason why my Patreon is free is that a lot of modern basketball coverage doesn't necessarily interact with like the day-to-day living of basketball players and basketball coaching. Things like narrative don't really enter into practice. You know, they don't enter into private skill workouts or into the weight room. And so what I wanted to do was get people who are interested in learning more about the day-to-day game and what players are seeing in their own film rooms, and being able to apply that because of failing, you know, most telecasts or breakdowns of the game are not, you know, are more interested in an entertainment product than just being straight informative. And
Mark Jackson saying he's going to hit Savannah James out of the park, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, Mark Jackson, a famously unemployed basketball coach. So I think that for me, what I try to do in my work is give people tools to apply to their own way of viewing the game. So I have two major series that I've been working on for this draft class. One is the heuristic, which is a tool to try to teach people how to scout from highlight videos, because highlight videos contain more truth than fiction in guard prospects. So like, if a guy can get to the rim against everybody, like, that's probably his skill. And then, you know, after going through like the 12 minute highlight video, I put in 10 clips of added context from me watching, you know, 8 or 10 games usually. And then I go through stat breakdowns to be like, okay, so what is it that I saw in this highlight tape that's present in stat breakdowns? What's not present? And I try to use, I have these five rules that I apply to each one and walk through so that people can, rather than be saying, oh, this is what PD thought about this player, be like, okay, so here's some tools that I can apply. So even if like, I'm wrong, which like I often am, and that's the purpose of my work is to be wrong. So I can go back later and be like, hey, look, here's the thing I was real dumb about. It's to give people tools so that in their own analysis, they can, you know, make a different argument for that player, or when they see something different, or could look back at their own, you know, previous analysis of players, have a perspective that may have a perspective that allows them to critique themselves more than the prospect. Because often our mistakes aren't because of what a player is, they're because of how we evaluated the player. Whether it's, you know, putting too much into the bit of information that, you know, this player was a bad interview, so you assume he's a bad teammate. Shout out to the Phoenix Suns, who thought that Kawhi was too nervous to be an NBA player, I believe, and he sweated through his suit. Yeah. Random information clutters our brains. And then my second series that I do is Slow Feed Don't Eat, which is my review of 10 different big prospects. You know, the heuristics for 10 cards, the Slow Feed Don't Eat isn't for 10 bigs, and walking through pick and roll coverages. So, you know, it's taking every type of pick and roll coverage that NBA teams run and then just showing clips of that particular big doing them and saying, okay, well, what here is fixable? What here is not fixable? What is it that the teams are looking for? Because a lot of times, like, somebody scores and it's not the, you know, it may not be the big's man, but it may be the big's fault. And so being able to parse that blame and understanding that, you know, certain coaches like certain schemes. You know, if you can't do ice, like, Tibbs will not like you, full stop. You could be the greatest big in the world. If you can't ice, like, he's going to be, it's really going to be hard for him. So what I'm looking for with every player that I watch is generally trying to figure out what scheme would be best for them. You know, how do they have to play to be successful? What is the best developmental pathway for them forward? And the tools that I use for that are, you know, looking at some stats. It's mostly, you know, film just from day job, but it's also, you know, looking around the league and seeing, like, you know, oh, cool, we have a whole bunch of people who love to run DHOs. This guy, you know, is terrible at a handoff, so he can't go to a DHO place. Or, you know, if you have a place that is, you have a like the old Spurs who turned around shooting. Okay, well, you can bet that they'll take worse shooters because they believe they can fix it. When I look at wings, I have six categories that I generally break skill development into. That's feel, dribbling, shooting, playmaking, point of attack, defense, off-ball defense, and role. And I try to categorize every wing into one area that will most likely return value. So, like, when I evaluate Isaac Okoro, the area of most concern for him that his evaluation comes down to is shooting. Like, if he can't shoot, he's a different type of prospect than if he can't shoot. And so going through each one of those, I try to give my readers, like, what I'm seeing when I see Isaac Okoro shoot, or what I see when I see Devin Vassell dribble. So it's a way of giving like both my opinion and a way of, like, if you want to evaluate this sort of idea in the future, here's the tools to do so, in the hopes that, like, if you took nothing else from this, here's a way to evaluate that going forward.
I guess you do a great job of explaining your, it seems very in depth to somebody who, you know, I played okay basketball and I feel like I read the game at an okay level. A lot of your readings of the game seem extremely detailed, and also, you know, at least when you're engaging with something that is different than from what you usually see from a reader's perspective, it can seem alienating. But in your writing and in your explanation, I think the layman's terms and the how you relay that information, I think, is valuable, because I think you do it in a good way. You also, as far as what you wrote about Malachi Flynn, you were gushing over his in-and-out dribble and how great it was. What do you think is the most advantageous dribble move that a player can use that allows them the easiest access to their pickup point of their jump shot that can feign as a pickup point? Then you could use a push dribble or a drop dribble. Like, which is your favorite dribble move that just allows for the most creation afterwards?
Left hand in and out. Whatever your powerful hand is, the opposite one. Oh my God. Like, if every, like, mediocre high school guard got a left hand in and out, they'd average 4 more points a game. Like, it is just one of those things that breaks people's brains, because they see someone dribbling with their left hand and think he's going back to the right. And you just give him a hard in and out. You can walk down to a left hand layup every single time. If we want to get just, like, a little more general, playing out of hang dribbles is super important. I, you know, like, Markel was just fantastic at this. And sometimes I'll just go back and watch the tape of him at Washington.
I love Markel, man. That's my favorite mixtape ever, I think, was his Washington mixtape. He's a genius. And he's one of my favorite players in the league. I love watching him play. He's amazing.
If you can get a hang dribble in and out, and then, like, if you just want to appeal to my heart, like, a T-Mac 3 is, like, my the final thing of like, if you just wanted to build the type of creator I love, like there's a clip of, on Twitter that I posted of Miles Powell just like doing just an absolutely perfect T-Mac over like a 6'9" dude. So T-Mac is where you hang dribble, and then as you're coming down from the hang dribble, you explode as hard as you can, usually with your outside foot towards the rim. And as you're as low as you possibly can, you pick up and shoot. So you're in a lunge position, and from the lunge position, you gather to shoot. And when you do it properly, you get about 9 feet of space, because the defender reads it as like, I have to go slide my feet to get back. And, you know, they watch like KD hit Braun with this for that like final head tap in the Golden State Cleveland series. And it's just one of those moves that like, once you really figure out the footwork, and it's hard to go from, you know, basically making an L with your body of pushing all of your weight horizontal and then pushing all your weight vertical back to back. But yeah, I could tell any guards listening, left hand in and out, work on your hang dribbles and T-Mac pull up. That is a package.
Yeah. As far as last question before I let you get out of here, who is the most deceptive, I guess, user of their pivot in the whole league? Is that too minute, or do you have a guy?
No. I mean, like, are we including travels? Because like Kawhi's the answer, because Kawhi just switches pivot feet, and it's incredible. Like, it's a really hard skill to learn how to travel in the NBA. Like, this sounds dumb, but like, NBA rules are different than everywhere else's rules. So like, guys are allowed to be creative in their interpretation of what could or couldn't be allowed, and it's also scaled by how much, you know, money you make. Like, yes, you know, second round draft picks aren't allowed to get a little Picasso-ish with their footwork. If you're Braun, if you're Harden, like, you're allowed a little more leeway, and that's fine and good. So like, I think that watching Kawhi figure out how to do the double pivot, like where you catch it, you establish a pivot foot, and then you take a second, then you repivot, is a thing that like, when you try to teach it to like young wings who, you know, are like, that's not a real move. And you just watch the compilation of Kawhi establishing a double pivot, and like, you'll see Pascal do it sometimes, and it's a layup almost every time. It's such a, because you catch it, you're facing away, you pivot the first time to like get to perpendicular. So usually for Pascal, it'd be right shoulder to the rim. And then you rip through again on the opposite pivot foot to get, you know, facing up to the rim. And you have to time it a certain way. Usually you want to do the first pivot just after your hands hit the ball, so that the ref is looking at the ball. Then you slide the first foot, and then you just go through a normal pivot. And a lot of really advanced footwork, you have to detach like from what your brain knows about, you know, travels. It's like teaching a person a euro step. Their brain says like, this is a travel, because the entire life they've been taught to travel. Same thing with the double rip through. Like, your brain thinks it's a travel, and then once you detach and the ref doesn't call it the first three times, then you're just roasting people with it.
Yeah. I love the, I guess, the interpretation aspect of it. I've made this point before in my writing, but I compared James Harden to a lawyer who's looking for precedent in a legal case from years back so that he can apply it today, and he gets away with it. And now it's just, that's how it exists. This is now the precedent. And his interpretations of the rules so that it could be advantageous for himself has been genius level. And, you know, the Kawhi Leonard one is a great example of that. Is there a guy in the post that you like a lot too?
Oh, if we can go with Jimmy Butler's stutter rip through, that's another absolutely fantastic one. So a stutter rip through is where you start a rip through. So we'll say going left to right. You get to about your midpoint, and then you act like you slow down and change back to your left. And so the defender reads this as you're going to your left, and then you just continue the rip through. So if you just right now we'll start on one of your shoulders, you rip it through to your waist, then come back to the left, then go back right. So catch the ball wide, then make a Z. People's brains turn off. When you start to bring it back left, they're like, oh, we're going left. It's okay. You rip back right, and it's over. You know, teaching this to high school and college guys. And I mean, just do this in a pickup game. And oh my God, I mean, obviously not right now because of the world we're in. But next time you get in a pickup game, copy that Jimmy Butler stutter rip through. And there's free 5 points before anybody figures it out. And that's before you even get to the counters or, you know, Euro out of it, pro hob, spin. Like, there's a lot of game out of just like some simple stuff.
Yeah, that's what, 45 extended. That's where he has it usually. It's that stutter. Yeah. And then if you can pro hop back into the middle and then kind of get funky with your pivot and just be strong in there like he is, yeah, he's a menace. That's a good one as well. How about any post players you want to I guess, highlight their pivot action, their footwork.
I mean, it feels cheating to say Sabonis just because, like, he had the greatest teacher of all. I mean, watching Jokic is really strange because, like, his center of gravity is really high. Like, usually guys who are great post players play through their hips. Like Hakeem, when you watch him, his center of gravity is essentially on the ground. But, like, Jokic, like, sort of, like, leans into you with shoulders and chest and just raises other people's, you know, center of gravity higher. And then he changes it up. I mean, it's interesting because he doesn't need the same angles everybody else does. Like, the Sunboard Shuffle is, you know, the feet are pointed really weird. Like, it, you know, most guys, like Cole Aldrich is famous for this. Like, he would get, you know, 45 degrees for a jump hook and he's either a swoosh or an air ball. But, like, he had to get his feet to 45 degrees, he wouldn't take the shot. Like, Jokic takes his shots from, like, the bizarre, ridiculous footwork angles where if you just paused it and, like, you know, and showed it to, like, a middle school or a high school coach or whatever, they'd be like, that's the worst shot I've ever seen. And then you hit play and he, you know, immediately banks it off the glass because he's, you know, seeing angles in a much different way. We're at a really wonderful time in our game where, you know, freedom is so emboldened that guys are, like, really trying things and going back to tape and trying, you know, being like, oh, well, the interpretation on this is different, so let me try to put some swing on it. I'm excited to see what guys bring back, especially because every year it feels like people go into the lab with whatever worked in the postseason. So I'm sure we're going to see a whole bunch more lessons learned from Jokic and Anthony Davis long runs into the postseason.
Yeah, my favorite Jokic one was when the guy tried to pull the chair and he just went up backwards and did a layup. Like, his interpretation of the game, because there's an infinite amount of interpretations for every single thing that happens. So it gets really interesting when a guy like Jokic starts just seeing the game and, like, those little, like, hit ahead passes in the space of 4 feet that he throws from, I guess, low post to the cutter, like Gary Harris or Jamal Murray, yeah, guys who are so good around the rim as well. Just the synergy that team plays with, and that, I guess, Jokic just kind of brings with him, as long as you're willing to get near the basket and have your hand out, is just, yeah, really fun time in the game.
Yeah, the first time I saw him throw that medicine ball chest pass, like the one where he throws it and just dies, like the ball, he lobs, it's sort of a lob, but it ends up going to, like, right in the person's hands at their waist. But it looks like he's throwing a medicine ball because he just, like, he lightly taps it, the ball just dies. And you're like, where is that going? And then Gary Harris, like, scoots in there, catches it at his knees and flips it up. And you're like, oh, I guess we have people who can throw that pass now. I guess we're making 6'11 people like that.
What's your read? I love Gary Harris. I think I adore his game. What's your read on his shot mechanics? What happened to that jumper, man?
I think that there's, like, a shoulder injury or something. Like, to me, it looks like somebody adjusting around an injury, whether it's, like, shoulder or ribs or something. It looks like a guy who's uncomfortable. Like, you know, the NBA is a job and we're all creatures of habit. And it seems like somebody who's trying to do something the same way as before, but there's, like, a pain involved or a discomfort in his upper body. History would say that Gary Harris is a very, very, very good shooter and that this is an aberration. I don't think it's an aberration of confidence. It seems to be an aberration of some physical discomfort. So I think that we're going to see him back to normal when the season starts on December 22nd or whatever.
I think so too. I wanted the Raptors to trade for him last year. I really, even though Powell ostensibly had a better year, I wanted Powell for Harris, but I know the Nuggets value Harris highly, correctly. Yeah. They do.
Yeah. So I also think that, like, I think that Jokic, well, he is like, it's seemingly easy to play with. I imagine learning his rhythms is a difficult adjustment for guards. Like, he makes your life easier, but you also have to, like, learn to play on his rhythm, which is very different than how basically everybody else in the league plays. So,
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, after you.
Malik Beasley, you know, everything aside from what's happened with him as far as recently his troubles with the law, of which the extent I'm not sure about, but from what I've read last, it has been not good. But I think he fit really well in with Karl Anthony Towns right away because of his, you know, aforementioned, I guess, having to deal with the quirks and rhythms of Nikola Jokic, could kind of slide in nice next to Karl-Anthony Towns, for example.
Yeah, I mean, and Towns has really developed as a passer. Like, that's one of the more interesting subplots. Like, I think that, you know, whenever you have somebody who's as ridiculous as something as Jokic, you don't really notice the people who are, you know, become very good, because, like, when you have had incredible very good, it's only but so interesting. But, yeah, Cat is going to continue to grow as a passer, just as teams have to respect the ridiculous shooting gravity. And I'm sure Malik Beasley being like, hey, so I saw Jokic this behind the back lob pass. You think you got that in the bag? Like, that's certainly got to help when, you know, you have a guy who's played with another creative passer being like, how do you feel about this angle?
Yeah. And just saying like, hey, like this angle, I've seen it used before. It's probably there for you. You're just as tall. The arms are there too. Like, you could probably make it work. And then, you know, you show this guy. I'm sure there's a sci-fi example or an allegory where a guy
it's a little bit of cultural exchange.
Yeah, exactly. All right, PD, this has been illuminating for me. Super enjoyable as well. Love to have you on at some point during the season. But before we get out of here, the floor is yours, man. Plug away whatever you think the people should be reading or listening to.
You can follow me on Twitter at AboveTheBreak3. In my bio is a link to my Patreon, where I have the aforementioned wing series, which has covered pretty much everybody in the first round who's a wing, with a few second round guys, along with the guard and center series. I do a podcast called It's About Joy, which is the least serious thing in the world, where I just call up somebody and talk about a basketball player who brought us joy for 20 minutes, and I make them very uncomfortable when I surprise them with a Bill Walton quote. It's a lot of fun, and it's also a nice change up in a difficult time. So if you would like really serious analysis, I can suggest the written work. If you would like something deeply unserious, the links to It's About Joy are up. I want to say thank you so much for having me. This has been a great conversation.
Yeah. And listener, I know a lot of you people who listen to the podcast enjoy my insights in my writing and via the podcast. For me, if you enjoy my takes on basketball, I think you'll really love PD's. I cannot co-sign his work enough. It's exhaustive. It's so wide-ranging, and it's just so minute in all the right places. I learned from it, and you will too. So, PD, thank you very much for coming on, man. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
All right, listener, that's it for the podcast. I'll see you next time, which will be with Blake Murphy, and we'll be talking about the free agency and what's coming with it. And obviously, everybody knows he's a genius when it comes to kind of understanding the cap, so we'll get into some of the implications with that. But this is it. It's over. And whether you're getting into this in the morning or at night, have a blessed day, and goodbye.